syndrome, whatever you want to call it. But no matter what you call it, it is a nightmare condition, a horror so consuming that more than one Morgellons sufferer has simply committed suicide rather than continue to deal with it. It's that bad. Those of you who are subscribers can hear the first four special programs anytime you'd like. They're in the archives, and they are, you'll never forget them, I guarantee you. Tonight's program will be no exception. The symptoms of Morgellons, boy, you could just take a wheelbarrow full of descriptors here and not have enough. They're weird, they're painful, they're medically inexplicable, they're intolerable, bizarre, and so on. They are an unidentified plague. So far, most of the so-called modern medicine institutions that we deal with has dealt with Morgellons sufferers with nothing short of arrogance, rudeness, and a lack of compassion, which is, to me, morally criminal. These people have been told they're hallucinating, go home, you're delusional, and they're not. Not at all. Thanks to our earlier four special programs and the heroic Morgellons sufferers who have been guests on those programs, the medical community and the CDC are now finally being forced to confront this issue. I don't know how honest they're going to be about it, but they're making noises. Tonight, another extremely important special program on Morgellons as we present to the world for the first time right here the latest scientific evidence about what Morgellons is or may be and how it is ravaging the bodies and lives of God only knows how many people now. Our special guests tonight, extraordinary people, scientists, doctors. First up, Dr. Hildegard Stanninger, Ph.D., R-I-E-T-1. She's an industrial toxicologist, an IH, and a doctor of integrative medicine. Dr. Hildegard Stanninger. Let me read her bio here. She is just an extraordinary wizard at her field of work and many others, a genius, according to many who know her. She is the author of the international environmental bestseller, The Comprehensive Handbook of Hazardous Material, Regulations, Monitoring, Handling, and Safety. Lewis Publishing, CRC Press, put it out. And it's among the leading international scientists she is in the field of industrial toxicology. She pioneered the use of biological monitoring tests for targeting organ exposure to parent compounds, metabolites, and their xenobiotics. Her research has opened the door to proteinomics, enzymomics, and genomics, as recognized by Johns Hopkins University, the Pandy Lab, and Harvard University's Medical College Small Molecule Genome Program. Former president of the Florida chapter of the American Industrial Hygiene Association and president and founder of the International Academy of Toxicological Risk Assessment, otherwise known as IATRA, Dr. Stanninger is well known in the world of this particular endeavor. She has much more in her bio, but I'm going to move on to our second guest now. He is equally as impressive. He is also considered a genius in his field. His name is Rahim Karju, and he's a medical doctor, also FASCP and FCAP. He works at the American Medical Diagnostic Laboratories in Santa Ana, California. Dr. Karju is an extraordinary man. He's a fellow of the College of American Pathologists and of the American Society of Clinical Pathology. Currently and for the past 14 years, Dr. Karju has been the laboratory director and pathologist of Doctors Hospital of West Covina, California, and of the American Medical Diagnostic Labs of Santa Ana. And concurrently, the past 10 of those years, he has been a clinical instructor in the pathology department at the University of Southern California. Dr. Karju was, for 10 years prior, the chairman and laboratory director of the CIGNA, Cigna Health Plan of California. Earlier in his career, he was on the clinical pathology teaching staffs at Yale University, the University of Connecticut Medical School, and Pahlavi University School of Medicine in Iran. He's an extraordinary man, and we're happy to have him tonight. Very honored to have both these people. Let's first say hello to Dr. Hildegard Stanninger. Hello, Dr. Stanninger.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here.
I'm glad you made it.
Me too.
We had a little phone tag going on there or something, I
understand. Yes, Dr. Karju and I were in the same room. We were trying to listen on the speakerphone.
Ah, no, it won't work. You sound good. And Dr. Karju, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome to the program, sir.
Thank you.
Dr. Staninger, when did you first come across Morgellons, and how did you become involved and interested in it, if not intrigued by it?
Over the summer, a colleague of mine, Ms. Shoshana Allison, said I should look at this, and Hilda, look at this. It's very interesting. Something is going on. And then I started to look at the pictures that were on the various websites, including your website.
Pretty frightening pictures they are.
It's very, very, and many different levels.
Yeah.
At the same time, then, in the recent, at the end of August, we were blessed by a private individual, a family that is known in the cattle industry out of Colorado, that funded a private study that allowed me to coordinate a number of the samples that were sent to me so that we could come up with some identification of what chemical composition, DNA, enzymes, whatever this thing may be.
Mm-hmm.
Because we were given total unknowns, I went through, there's about five labs involved, including Dr. Carju's, which was to identify some slides with pathology, which I gave to him as total unknowns.
So he got them blind. He didn't know what they were supposed to be or anything
total,
else.
Total blind, Mr. Entz, total mm-hmm. blind. Mm-hmm. He did not even know what tissues, meaning he is a very trained pathologist. He taught at Yale University,
right.
And he's been in it many decades in this field.
Well, that's the way to do it. And the other four labs?
The other four were with electron microscope,
mm-hmm.
Gas chromatograph, mass spec, high-pressure liquid chromatography, and the latter to confirm even any crystals that we could find.
Uh-huh.
We were using Raman and micro-Raman.
And again,
which is a laser, which goes down to 23 zeros, which goes down to the atom using the micro-Raman.
Wow. All right, well, that's about as state-of-the-art as you're going to get. And again, did you send these samples out blind to these other four labs?
Blind. I sent them out blind. I've used some of these labs for over 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in the environmental field for just under 30 years and as a industrial toxicologist. So I wanted to know what this was and if it could be also multiple things. By multiple things, meaning if you
mm-hmm.
look at some of the pictures that are on your site as with on other sites,
mm-hmm.
They look like parasites. They could be bacteria. They definitely got some string material in there.
Right.
And it could even because color coding, meaning different fibers, and what they could be.
So they're presenting multiple potentials here. We just don't know what they are yet. But
correct.
We're making progress. We're going to hear tonight, I guess, some pretty amazing laboratory analyses and findings.
Right. And you will hear what we have discovered not only in the pathology, and what we've discovered on, a single fiber that was isolated.
Very good. Okay, well, I look forward to that. This is going to be fascinating. By the way, for all of you who are on the Internet, go to Rentz.com, and you'll see the Morgellons disease featured story box right up near the top. And the New York Times today picked up the story, interestingly enough, on the day we do our special program. So we are forcing these people in the media to begin to take an honest look at something that has been, again, dealt with derision, absurdity and other unpleasant descriptors by the medical community. Dr. Staninger, the idea of sending someone home with a disease, a disorder, an affliction, a syndrome like this with some kind of a diagnosis of delusional parasitosis is so insulting to me. And after talking to the people who have had this disease on the program and do suffer with it now, it makes me ill. How is our medical community falling so utterly flat on its face and doing so with arrogance that they ought to have their rear ends paddled?
I know it's very upsetting for any professional to say that someone's delusional when in the majority of these cases that at least I've talked to several individuals that they can literally pull these fibers out of their skin. Even what was shown on ABC on that special that was on the medical side of the Morgellons, identifying that they couldn't find the fibers identified in the FBI lab, that they found something physical, so how can it be delusional?
Correct. I mean, that's kind of a given, and yet that's the diagnosis that a lot of these people are given. And I wouldn't be at all surprised to find out that many of them, Dr. Staninger, have been given antidepressants, perhaps, and other chemical solutions, which are going to make the situation worse. We do know that SSRIs can radically increase the likelihood and potential of suicide in people that begin taking them. So anyway, this thing has been mishandled from day one. We're going to go a long way tonight to at least help distribute the information to the world that will alert and perhaps alarm some of the medical establishment that this is an issue that needs very strict attention, and immediately so. In the Morgellons Disease featured story box, you'll see the second story link, Morgellons findings and lab photos. That deals directly with our guests tonight, and the photos are up there. And in third story is a list of symptoms of Morgellons disease. Fascinating. Keep following these stories down. You'll find a list of photographs as well, which are amazing. Be right back. Okay, and welcome back. Very special guests tonight. Just people literally leading the world in the investigation of Morgellons disease. Dr. Hildegard Stanninger and Dr. Rahim Karju. A couple more questions of Dr. Stanninger, then we're going to meet Dr. Karju. But let me very quickly welcome Jan Smith to the program. Jan, are you there?
Yeah, hi, Jeff. Good to talk to you.
Well, thanks. Welcome back. And for those of you who may have heard any of our earlier programs, Jan has had Morgellons now for, if I remember, 8.5 years, Jan?
Yeah, that's correct.
And you still got it.
Yeah, still got it.
All right. If you'd stand by, we're going to get to you a little bit later, but I wanted to bring you on here and let everyone know you are with us tonight.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. And for everyone who is online, if you can, go to the Morgellons Disease featured story box. It's right there at the top of Rents.com, and scroll down to the last link in that box, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Click on it. It says Morgellons Mystery Disease Data Files. These are our data files. Click on that, and the page that you'll see will present you with a photograph, a color photograph, of some of the Morgellons fibers. And if that doesn't shake you up, nothing will. Remember, this is not a bacterium. This is not a virus. It's something else. So you've got a lot to look at there. Okay, Dr. Stanninger, the article we have up there presents a couple of excerpts from your paper that you just presented. And if you would, tell us a little bit about these two extracts. One deals with the FDA, the EPA, and nanotechnology, and the other talks about... Well, let's go through these one at a time.
Okay. The item in which I covered in my paper was involving... FDA, where the FDA currently under the Unified Dietary Supplement Act has no regulations involving nanotechnology.
None.
Nanotechnology specifically that I'm addressing is technology that can be used into food products, even like killing other bugs or viruses.
Well, the idea of spraying viruses on food to kill bacteria that could theoretically kill us. And
correct.
This is all now. And what you're saying, if you can in the studio, let's turn Jan down. I think that may be part of our presence problem. There we go. Thanks. She's still there, but I just want to keep that phone down.
In my paper, I presented that the Woodrow Wilson International Center was basically the only, I'm going to call it, entity that was looking at this type of problem.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, they recognized they had did a private study through Luxor, L-U-X-O-R research group,
mm-hmm.
which is in Washington, D.C., that said that this is going to be a phenomenon. I don't remember the exact number, but it was like $14 billion or something like that in the next 14 years, or $30 billion.
Right, so what you're saying is, and we've talked about this on the program before with other guests, nanotechnology is running amok. It is not being regulated at all to the extent it should be, considering the potential catastrophic results that nanotechnology could yield in very short order, too. Is that correct?
Correct. I mean, it's just sort of illogical the way it's being approached, because the logic is saying, okay, we have something that's small, very, very small, that's at least 9 decimals, but that's what the nano level is.
9 decimals. Oh, jeez. Okay.
At the same time, we know that this can get into a cell, because we've had this experience with retroviruses and AIDS, that it got into the cell and replicated.
Yep.
And look what that did to society.
Yep.
But at the same time, these other technologies that can also, if they're mutated, meaning using like a mutated RNAi or SI, that's even, say, maybe used with materials from a fungus, and it's in there. Fungus are very unique. They can blend into our DNA and make other things happen.
This goes almost all the way back to the work of Royal Rife, who said that fungus, yeast, and mold could turn into bacteria, could turn into virus, and so forth, and actually morph into different shapes depending upon the medium in which they're growing, i.e. the human body.
Correct, and that's what the zoogens, I can't pronounce it correct right now, so forgive me, audience.
That's all right.
But when you use different compounds, example, like if you were exposed to aspartame versus monosodium glutamate,
mm-hmm.
that combination predisposes the body, then you get infected, and then something else happens.
That's right. Now, what you just said is really important, and I've been harping on this for 13 years now. Your body is like a petri dish. If your body becomes toxic, polluted, or otherwise compromised, things grow. It's real simple. Clean your body and things won't grow, and that's That is truly the bottom line of health. You keep polluting yourselves with fast food and junk and poisons, a lot of which, of course, you have no control over because of the lies on the labeling acts in this country. But let me read, if I can, may I call you Hildy?
Oh, please do.
Thanks. Okay. I'm going to read this statement that was extracted. All of you have it on the Internet, but for those of you who are not online now, Dr. Staninger wrote, nanotechnology is the ability to control things at an atomic and molecular scale of between 1 and 100 nanometers, and has been met with enthusiasm across a variety of industries. Operative word there, industries, think profits. Critics highlight the murky area of how nanoparticles affect toxicity and say nanoparticles should be treated as new, potentially harmful materials and tested for safety accordingly. And certainly, well, they should. Unlike pharmaceuticals, which must go through a series of pre-market approvals, finished dietary supplements need no pre-market approval. Under the Dietary Supplemental Health and Education Act, DSHEA, which is part of the Food and Cosmetic Act, only ingredients not marketed in the United States before October 1994 must be approved by the FDA before use in consumer products. Thus, as it stands, pre-market regulation of nanotechnology in dietary supplements, biological pesticides, and other man-made nanotechnology does not fall under FDA, EPA, OSHA, FIFRA, and other regulatory agencies in the United States, for the simple reason that nanotechnology is so small that the conventional regulatory laboratory methods do not have equipment to measure at 9 decimals below the zero. Back in just a minute with much more. Okay, back with Dr. Hildegard Staninger, Ph.D., and Dr. Raheem Karju, M.D. This is a world first for you. We're going to put this out tonight and issue a challenge to the medical community, not only in the United States, but all over the world, to deal with this issue, and let's find out what we're up against. If I can just read a little bit more from Dr. Staninger's paper, an excerpt. You can read it there. It's in the Morgellons box for those of you who joined us late. She writes, Morgellons, a disease in which individuals have the growth of fibers from their skin that burn at 1,700 degrees Fahrenheit and do not melt at all. A private study to determine the chemical and biological composition of these fibers has shown that the fiber's outer casing is made up of high-density polyethylene fiber. Let me read that again. A private study to determine the chemical and biological composition of these fibers has shown that the fiber's outer casing is made up of high-density polyethylene fiber, HDPE. The fiber material is used commonly in the manufacture of fiber optics. I'm going to stop right there because we're going to get into this in detail as we progress. Anything you want to add, Hildy, right now? I'm going to bring on Dr. Karju.
Yes, on this particular statement, I have an individual that was female
mm-hmm.
in our facilities where I'm a toxicologist in Pensacola Intracell
mm-hmm.
in Pensacola, Florida. And this particular fiber was taken, a piece of her skin fell off, and it was taken from there. It was singly isolated. And the high-density polyethylene fiber is, not the fiber, but the high-density polyethylene compound is used in the coating of viral protein envelopes, which have other genetic material inside of them.
That are
inside the materials, if you look up that term under the Internet or any virology book where they're making viral protein envelopes, which are now used in cancer treatment, they're used in biological pesticides, et cetera, that they have different colored strings. The different colored strings are genetically added different enzymes or genome materials that will go to, like, say, I'm going to say regulations that will go to the liver or go to a different portion of a human body if it's treating for cancer. If it's, like, used for killing a mosquito larvae, it will go to a certain portion of the mosquito larvae, but not affect the pupa, of a larvae.
Got it.
Of a mosquito. So it's definitely site-specific and site-generating, but in some stages that if it's absorbed, no one knows what the answer could be on how it's going to mix with our human body, other animals, other living life forms.
Now, the other side of that coin is if for any of you who have seen the color photographs, and I would urge you again to scroll down to the last link in the Morgellons disease box at Rentz.com. Click on that. You'll see a color photo of these fibers. And there are a number of different colors, 4, 5, 6 of them. And that's what Hilde is talking about here. We're going to get into detail.
Right,
go ahead.
These fibers, when you look in the virology books on how to make viral protein envelopes, they're specific, meaning the chartreuse red is specific for something, the blue, the green, and then they talk about a yellow fiber.
So these are not random.
These are the same colors that are being shown in these photographs that individuals that have been suffering from Morgellons or other diagnosis that is related to Morgellons are experiencing, no matter where they are in the world.
Okay, very good. With that, let's bring on Dr. Raheem Karju, M.D., of the American Medical Diagnostic Laboratories in Orange County, Santa Ana, California. Hello, Dr. Karju. Thanks for being patient.
Thank you very much.
Now, how did you get involved in this whole Morgellons, and it is an explosive controversy. It's going to be talked about for a long time to come. This is a very scary issue for a lot of people. Tell us how you got involved.
Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to work with Dr. Stenger, Hildegard, and once in a while he gave me a lot of surprise.
I'll bet. So you've worked with her. You'd worked with her before.
Yes, we've been working together before, and about a month or something ago, he sent me a box of a slide, and she said that I would like you to go ahead and look to see what you find.
Right. She didn't tell you. She told you nothing.
I saw the bone, joint, and soft tissue that it's completely degenerated and fragmented of bone and inflammation of the joint tissue and soft tissue. And meanwhile, I saw the crystalloid type of material similar to silicon and silica. And I took several pictures of those and I gave it to her. And it's still, she's not telling me too much about this individual patient. And about a week ago, she sent me another box of a slide, and she said that I would like Dr. Karju to find something. And attached to this slide, there was a small plastic bag that there was some sort of the fiber or something, and I put it under the microscope. I saw the fibers that single or branching, and then some of them, they had the blonde end, and some of them, they had a sharp edge. And then I called him. I said that, what's going on? He said, oh, did you see Morgellon? I said, I don't know what you're talking about. I never see anything like that. Then she said, those things are coming from the skin. Then there was one of them that was very interesting, and tonight I show it to her also. And there was a skin that there was some, like a hood, arm, or some pointed type of like a bird nose is coming out of the skin.
Mm-hmm.
And I took several pictures of it already. And it was very amazing for me. And then he told me all about it, as you heard it from her tonight, about Morgellons.
Have you ever heard, had you even heard of Morgellons before?
No. No, mm-hmm. I don't know where she found this name.
Mm-hmm.
I went through the parasitology and I saw, you know, it thought that it's probably micro, they called it micro fiber type of the parasite.
So you were thinking initially that perhaps parasite, and these are microfibers relating to some kind of parasitic infestation. Okay, very good. That's logical.
Yeah.
Stand by, if you would, Dr. Carju. We have to break. We'll come right back with more. And this is quite a story. I'm glad you're all along tonight. Stay tuned. We'll continue in just a couple minutes. In the meantime, do look at the material in that first box, the Morgellons box. The first link, the New York Times story today. The second link dealing with what we're talking about right now and the pictures we're going to be looking at. And then scroll down to the last link in the box. Click on that for our data file of all our Morgellons information. And look at the pictures. You'll see what we're talking about. Dr. Staniger described them as various colored fibers. Take a look. We'll be back. Okay, back with our fifth special on Morgellons disease. Dr. Hildegard Staniger is here, PhD. And Dr. Rahim Carju, MD, is with us now. Dr. Carju, go ahead with your narrative here. We have a lot of photographs up, as you probably know, on the site. One is entitled Fat Cells with Rivers of Silicon. Let's go ahead with your description of what you were seeing when she was sending you these samples and how you progressed to at least coming up with a reasonable identification of some of the material.
Yeah. Then I thought that probably we are dealing with the parasite, they call it microfilaria. Microfilaria usually go to the lymphatic and cause the elephantiasis.
Oh, really? So that's what causes elephantiasis?
Yeah.
Microfilaria.
That's what microfilaria would do.
I see.
But the history and the type of this Morgellon that I am looking, it's different because it's branching and it's like a hair curling around itself.
I see. Hildy, go ahead.
And what I was trying to say is I don't want the audience confused because the first set of tests with the pathology with Dr. Carju looked at where he identified the silicone and the silica, and these were from tissue biopsies of an individual. And then this same individual sent me fibers and also other material that was excreting from the tissue of her skin,
mm-hmm.
and that's what Dr. Carju is talking about now. He thought definitely, and you could see it. He took pictures of it, but they're not developed. We're going to send them to you.
Okay.
But it's definitely, as he was saying, the coiled fiber, and also different color fiber in it, and then also this like parasite, as he was saying. It looks like a parrot, like the beak of a parrot.
Right.
Put a ball in it.
Okay.
It looks just like that.
Now, the pictures on here, on the story we have up, photograph number 2-2, photograph of silica crystalloid material and silicone from an individual diagnosed with osteoarthritis of the right knee. That same patient had been diagnosed by other physicians for delusional parasitosis, which has been associated with patients having Morgellons disease or unknown dermatosis syndrome. The biopsy taken here was from the right knee area of the patient in New Hampshire and so forth. It shows kind of a matrix of, for those of you not online, of, well, what are they, Hildy?
In that slide, the first picture that was photograph 1-1, that is a photograph that Dr. Carju took when he was he's world-renowned in his breast work with silicone breast implants and identification of the silica mm-hmm. and the silicone that was associated with that. That is an actual photograph that he used in court and also in his lectures throughout the world in reference to the effects of silicone breast implants. That was a silica crystalloid. The second photograph is a picture of a silica crystalloid and silicone that he found in the knee tissue specimens that were sent to me.
So photograph 2-2 shows a silica crystalloid. Looks like a little round, it's kind of an oval. It looks like a bean, actually. And that's sitting right in there inside of, I guess, inside of the tissue sample.
Yeah, a lattice of tissue.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
And what the similarity, because he was immediately the one who pointed it out to me. He said, Hilda, I want to show you something. And he pulled off from his shelf in his office photographs of what he did with the breast implants. And he said, don't they look alike? And I said, they sure do. Mm-hmm. And I said, a micro-Raman test is the only thing that confirm it inexclusively, but at the same time, they look alike. It's definitely a crystalloid material.
Okay. All right. Dr. Carju, go ahead, please.
Yeah, but I could not really say that what the silica I saw in the tissue of the joint has any similarity right now with what I see with the material and the slide that Hildegard sent me.
Right. And let me add into this. This new material that he's talking about, the same patient that sent me under this private study the tissue samples that were coordinated through her hospital that she had the surgery in,
right.
These were fibers and materials that were taking off. In other words, same person, but what was found deep in the tissue at the knee joint is not the same thing that is found in the second set, which I'll call phase two pathology, which had these fibers and also this, I'm going to call it parasitic thing that looked like a, you know, the bill of a parrot with a ball in it.
There's one thing that here is saying that these fibers is surviving even 1,700 Fahrenheit temperature.
Right.
I wonder this, what we see on the skin, could be changed into another type of the chemical like silica or silicone, and then it get in through the, go travel through the body. These are the things that we have to really study these kind of the patients. First of all, we have to examine them. Take those one that is coming out of the skin. Then we do the several biopsy through. Then also the latest things, we have to create the antibody against these fibers or whatever is coming from the skin. And then do the biological testing and immunology testing. Just like what we did several years with the silicone implant, that we examined their blood and we find out, yes, there is an antibody created in their body that's what caused them the diseases.
Right, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the body's antibodies would be, or the body's immune system could defeat these fibers.
Yes.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes, that's what we have to really study. It's just the beginning, some sort of the work biologically.
You got
to
start somewhere.
What we are dealing with.
Right. Okay. So no one's identified antibodies yet to these fibers, but you're suggesting that they may well be there if we look.
Yes, we have to create an antigen, putting it in the test tube. And then put the blood of this individual to see if there is a reaction. And then if there is a reaction, we have an antibody created due to the effect of these, whatever
I see.
The Morgellons is.
Whatever the Morgellons is.
Yes.
Hildy, so if you could rephrase what he said, that he's suggesting that it may be possible that the, if I read it right, if I heard it right also, silica crystalloid material could somehow yield these fibers?
No. What he's, Dr. Carju is saying is that whatever is in these people's bodies,
mm-hmm.
whether it's, which I personally think there's multiple things going on,
right.
being if it's a parasite like a nematode, which is very, very small,
mm-hmm.
say carried by a viral protein envelope that's in a nematode egg, and you inhaled it, then versus the fibers, whatever they are made out of,
I see.
Any of those types of identification, as Dr. Carju pointed out, you can take their blood and make an antibody test so that then you can identify, so that you can have some kind of clinical test that will help physicians to diagnose these individuals.
Diagnose Morgellons.
Correct, correct.
Okay,
because
now...
they all have something similar to them.
Right. Who is it? Who would make a viral protein envelope and put a nematode or a nematode egg in it?
That type of technology is being used in pesticide applications,
okay.
biological pesticides.
So they use nematodes in supposedly a natural pesticide.
Right, in an egg-like situation.
Okay.
Meaning these are very, very, you know, like if you had the point of a needle,
right.
that's how small these eggs are. Now, I want to add something that Dr. Carju mentioned. We originally started with phase one pathology, which was looking at these prepared slides, okay, of the individual that was diagnosed.
Now, these aren't slides like photographs, folks.
No, no, no. These are slides prepared
slides. These are slides of material. Okay.
They were done by a hospital that she went into, and they forwarded them to me for
mm-hmm,
the study.
Okay. They're samples on slides.
Correct.
Right.
I mean, they're pathological slides. Correct, Dr. Carju?
Right.
Yes.
Okay. Then the phase two is the same individual sent these fibers in her prepared slides, by prepared slides meaning cover slips over them, taped
right.
down so that they could be contained.
You high school biology students know what we're talking about.
Right,
okay.
And he looked at them. I mean, there is something there. There's fibers, and I'm going to call it this parasite with this, like, hook thing on it. And he took photographs, and we will forward them to you so that the audience can see them. Then the third phase, which we just got today, literally yesterday, and I brought it over to his laboratory today before the show, which was from a colleague of mine, Dr. Michael Castle, that I've known for a number of years. He was given, that was on Cornicom, I believe that's
Cornicom. Clifford Cornicom's website.
Yes, there was a individual in the year 2000 named, or I think it's 2000 or 2001, named Larry, and he sent Dr. Castle some samples of a comb and two packets with this fiber in it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We just put it under the microscope, and in the fiber, you see the reddish fibers and you see the white fibers, but in one particular set of fibers, which Dr. Carju is going to prepare slides and take pictures of and also forward this to you,
mm-hmm.
Is you can see, you know, if you had something segmented, and you see, like, if you ever looked at worm eggs in a sack.
Understand.
It looks just like that in it, because then he pulled a piece of my hair and put it under that, and he said, see, you don't see anything inside your hair, but you see something that's alive in there, but I don't know what it is.
Oh, my. All right, well, the puzzle gets more
curious. And that came from this individual's hair.
Understand. Well, there
was
a...
You know what I'm telling you, Hindegard is really keeping me on the toe.
Yes, it will keep you on your toes. Now, stand by. We have to break. We'll come back. We did have a guest on our last program from Australia, and she described how the hair on her forehead had been replaced by these fibers, she felt, and felt that they were moving. Now, think about that. All right, hold on. We'll be back with more The Morgellons Mystery. All right, welcome. Let's step up into hour number two of our fifth special program on Morgellons disease, Morgellons syndrome, Morgellons affliction. We're not sure, but we're making progress. This is extraordinary information tonight. Our special guests are Dr. Hildegard Staninger, Ph.D., and Dr. Rahim Carju, M.D., absolutely top people to be investigating this terrible nightmarish disease, whatever you want to call it, which has afflicted, we don't know how many people. It literally could be worldwide, probably is worldwide now, and there could be tens of, maybe hundreds of thousands. We don't know how many people have it. We just don't know. To recap, if we can, Hildy, the first hour, what have we established then to date and to this point in our conversation that we've talked about. We've got, you suggest, I think, something, some kind of a parasite. But beyond that, we have another factor, maybe multiple factors, and that second factor would certainly be the multicolored fibers. As Dr. Carjou described, some of them are blunt-tipped, some of them with a sharp end on them. We had earlier reports from some of the sufferers that they were seen to actually move the white ones, but I'm not sure about that. A motile kind of a factor was introduced. But so, what do we have so far in our conversation tonight?
Also, I want to add to what you just summarized that none of us have looked at, even if there were, it's a parasite, as Dr. Carjou has seen under the slide, which we honestly don't know the classification of it.
You don't recognize it.
We don't recognize it. We've looked through standard parasitology.
So it's an unknown critter, if it is a critter.
Because he has a fully certified laboratory in many classifications for 25 years, so his staff knows what to look for.
And if he doesn't see it, we don't know what the hell it is.
Right. And at the same time, I will say that in some parasites, it can leave like a tunnel. It can follow through, like if it's a skin parasite under the skin, under connective tissue or dermis, and follow in tunnel. And maybe this is what these individuals are seeing.
Like a mole.
Like a mole,
in the
definitely.
Soil.
Like a mole, or a mole cricket, too. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, in some cases, like with earthworms, you know, they have waste, which are called castings, and they come out. Some like a, slug or a snail, they leave this residue behind it.
Yes, long stringy things.
Right. And I'm not saying, I don't know if that high-density polyethylene fiber, meaning what we're called, we know it is a high-density polyethylene fiber. It could be from carpet, but it wasn't. It was from this individual's skin, and she had it completely sealed up because it was all in bandages and everything. The thing is that this last group of specimens, which we got received from Dr. Mike Castle, there's definitely in, I'm going to call it that string of material, it looks like a string of what I would call cysts, which are little sacs that worm eggs are in, which they usually have about 4 to 6 eggs inside of
it. Now, this is not the fibers. We're talking about something else.
No, we're talking about something else. This was given to Dr. Mike Castle, this individual named Larry, okay?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
But what I'm saying is, I'm just saying, if that were a cyst or an egg of some species that could be, and I don't know, could be this phase two specimens that we saw where it has this hook-like thing, which is not really a hook, it's like a bill, like a bird with a ball in its mouth, that they just haven't hatched or anything. I'm not saying that they're the same species, but they could be.
So these cysts, you're saying, just for those of you out there who may not know what she's talking about, it's not like a bump in your skin. It's like trichinosis in ham. It's a cyst. It's a stage in the development.
It's a sac, which it has a number of eggs in it.
That's right.
And that's what they call, you know, in parasitology.
Okay.
Now, the thing is that, say, if it was engineered or anything of that line, because of the high-density polyethylene, which is used on viral coatings, it could be in a tube, in a, you know, some fiber with a bunch of eggs in it.
Was the string of cysts small enough to have been somehow disgorged or ejected from one of these fibers? Or is it bigger than that?
It looked like it was inside a fiber, wouldn't you say, Dr. Carjou?
Yes, it's quite different from any synthetic fiber that you see, which is a solid, but this one has a translucent type of a cover, and you can see like some sort of the
nuclear matter.
Yeah, some sort of the living things has been. So, tissue type thing inside of those fibers.
Now,
you see it in high microscopic field.
Taken pictures of it, too.
Okay, this idea of a beak-like thing with a ball in it, in its mouth, if that's what it
have
is.
Have you ever seen furniture that has the ball and claw?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that ball, but just the claw, like Italian. you know, that's a bird, what it
a bird,
looks like.
A bird talon.
Yeah, it looks
okay.
just like that.
Okay, now...
But long, is, like a snake.
Is that showing... It's, I would assume it's dead if it was alive when you got it, but... Or was it alive?
I don't think any of this stuff was alive. Was it, Dr.
Okay.
Carju?
Yeah, this really, right now, it's very early to discuss, to imagine that what is this kind of the fibers at the coming out of the skin, or maybe this one was long time, a few patients had it, but now we are dealing with the epidemic type of the problem because there's so many individual coming out when they hear it, then they say, oh, yeah, I have it for a few years and I didn't know what it is.
Correct.
I go to the doctor and doctor called me and said, are you crazy?
Yeah, here, take these pills. We have reports of Morgellons syndrome now on all seven continents, I believe. If not all seven, we're very close to that.
Yeah.
So we don't know how many have it. We just don't know. Now, so far, what we have are fibers. We have perhaps a string of little cysts. We have some kind of a talon-looking item with a ball in it. Now, Dr. Carju, you probably have been told that Morgellons sufferers who have the lesions on the skin report that none of the lesions, beside not healing, ever become infected with bacteria.
This is true. What I make is sections of the histology section and review them under the microscope. Some of these are so much ulcerated with lot of inflammation and even microabscesses formation. And I am doing right now a special stain to see what kind of course, when there is the infection, ulceration of the skin, there are a lot of the microorganisms or the fungi would grow there. That's what I'm right now studying, doing all those special test to see that what else is, you know, saprophyte with this, the fibers, whatever, Morgan disease and whatever we are going to call it. So there are so many things. As soon as there is a crack on the skin, there is a lot of germs growing there and then contribute more ulceration and more problem and itching. And then it would go into the systemic disease.
Systemically,
Right.
But currently, he's only seen the swelling and the inflammation, and I don't believe from the slides that were prepared, Dr. Carju, you didn't see any infection from those prepared slides, did you? Outside of just deterioration of the bone?
No, those ones, kind of skin, fragment of skin you sent me that
correct.
I made a tissue section, I saw.
Correct. And these were from the same individual that gave us the prepared slides. These were from, she sent a collection of fibers and tissue samples, you know, meaning like pieces of skin. And that's what he's talking
about
now.
Those are the ones that have the fiber, too.
I think all of you are, what you're hearing, all of you out there, and it's fascinating, are two brilliant scientists tackling an unknown. And they are leading the charge to find out what this is about. Of course, the CDC far behind, but they're at least talking about it. So what we hope to have happen is that their data will be examined and given the publication in the peer-reviewed journals that it certainly will warrant. We have to take a break right now. When we come back, we'll say hello to Jan Smith, who has been with us tonight. In fact, Jan has been on all of our first four special programs dealing with Morgellons. And again, you heard Dr. Carju, and we've talked about it before. This is an epidemic issue now. It is not just a few people.
Yeah.
We don't know how many are ill. It could be a million worldwide. We just don't know, because people who are afflicted with this issue are not getting doctors' diagnoses. There is no database being compiled. Nothing. Nothing.
I wanted to mention these for the doctors. These patients are not crazy. These people have a problem of the skin.
Yes.
And
at least the skin.
They have a neurological problem.
That's right. Stand by, Dr. Karjua. When we come back, we'll ask you to repeat that. We have to take a break real quick here. No delusion, folks. This is a real deal, and it is not a joke. We'll be right back. Okay, right back with you. Let's continue our conversation. If you would, Dr. Karjua, go ahead and restate that for us, that these people are not hallucinating. And
yep.
And I'd also like to get your impression of how the medical establishment is dealing so far with Morgellons epidemic.
Well, I am hearing from some of these individuals that they have this problem. They said that month and month I go to my doctor, they said that, okay, why don't we give you some sleeping pills or some sort of things to calm down?
Mm-hmm.
There is some problem mentally and all this.
Right.
This is not the mental problem. This is a disease that today we have to go ahead and investigate to see really what is going on. Now, our laboratory is willing to get all these specimens, fibers or biopsies, and we will be happy to perform the test without any charge.
Wow.
And we send in, we find out this is a section of the research, and we are willing to go ahead and do it. Also, we have a clinic that is known for prevention of cancer and environmental diseases. We will be happy to meet this individual, to do physical exam, to do the biopsy again without any charge, because we would like to find out what we are dealing today with this kind of the problem exists. And as I said, maybe it was a long time. Now it became like epidemic. And there are a lot of people are suffering from this. And I will be happy with the help of Hildegard and other staff of the American Medical Diagnostic Lab and the cancer prevention and toxicology clinic that we have. We will be happy to do physical exams, do the biopsy, perform the test, and even blood test without any charge.
That is absolutely extraordinary. It's heroic is what it is. And Hildy, this is this is what the CDC ought to be doing. And here once again.
You're welcome to be here with us.
That's right. Here we have heroic people from the private sector moving forward with doing the work of the government. Well, nothing new there, is there? Okay. I want to go back to something that you mentioned that some of you heard, some of you may not have heard, but it's very, very important. And we will have Jan Smith on in just a few minutes. But this is a key part of our conversation so far this evening. And that is the material sent to Dr. Hildegard Stanninger by Dr. Mike Castle. These samples, or this sample, I assume there were several samples.
There were three samples. One
right.
was a greenish-colored comb that is used like a parasite comb, you know,
right.
like if you have lice.
Right.
Then there was two little Ziploc teeny-tiny bags that you put like jewelry in, and they had one a white fiber, you know, a big coil thing, and a little tiny fiber thing.
Okay, now, here's the punchline, ladies and gentlemen. Where did those samples come from, Hildy?
These samples came from what was given. I can read to you what he sent me, okay?
Well, yeah, and let me just sum it up before you read. They came from chemtrails, ladies and gentlemen. Chemtrail goo. Okay, are we on the same page now? And what year was this again?
This was sent to Dr. Castle on Saturday, June 3rd, 2000, at 1834 minutes.
Okay, now that would have put it right in the middle of the most heavy chemtrailing of the United States. It began around 1996, 97, and has slowed down somewhat in the last year or two in most places. But right around 2000, 2001, it was fierce. So this sample came from chemtrail goo. Go ahead, Hildy.
Okay, I'm going to read you Dr. Castle's letter to myself, which says, from Castle Concepts and Associates, which is located in Columbus, Ohio. Hilda, enclosed here with are the remaining fiber samples sent to me by, quotes, Larry in June 2000. Hope you are able to find something significant out about these. I sent Larry's typewritten note along with the samples are COC, requesting them to your organization this date, October 19th, 2006, at 9 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time.
Mm-hmm.
Please send me a copy of analysis or findings. Sincerely, R. Michael Castle. And this is Larry's, and it says subject SOS. Mike, if you're reading the post on Carnicom's message board, you are aware that the West Coast is being punished. I'm sending three recently collected samples that may be significant. One is a tangled mass of fibers that I washed from my hair. In this mass is one whitish fiber that is obviously coated with a virtual, V-I-T-R-O-L, blue substance. This coated fiber is of great interest to me. A second sample is a fine-toothed lice comb
mm-hmm.
containing God knows what.
Mm-hmm.
I see our old friend, the fiber, in three colors, a substance that looks like a translucent pink gem, J-E-M, and numerous particles of what may be inorganic minerals. Hope you find these as interesting as I, Larry.
What Larry was talking about when he said the West Coast was being punished was the amount of chemtrail aerosol operations that were conducted at that time. And Carnicom.com, that's Clifford Carnicom, C-A-R-N-I-C-O-M, Carnicom.com. Clifford has the premier chemtrail website of them all. He's another one of our heroes. All right, we'll be back. And you heard Dr. Carju's offer. We're going to get the information up to let you with Morgellons know how to contact him. And we will find out in due course what this is about. It may take a lot of work, but we've got the brains and we have the energy. And we have you folks out there to help us. We'll be back. Okay, right back with you, Dr. Hildegard Staninger, Ph.D., and Dr. Rahim Carju, M.D., who has, just along with Dr. Staninger, made an extraordinary offer to try to blast the doors open on this mystery. Okay, I hope all of you heard that real loud and real clear. We're talking about the potential of chemtrail involvement with Morgellons disease. Can't prove it yet. But what we know about these fibers and what we know about the chemtrail samples, Hildy, what's the overlay?
Well, I know, when I looked at this phase three, which are these fibers that we're just talking about right now.
Yes.
And Dr. Carju showed me, and he even took a piece of my hair and showed me that, hey, these things that, as we stated earlier, look like cysts or something alive inside, but
mm-hmm.
they're not moving around, meaning there's something in it, okay?
Yeah, I mean biological looking.
Yeah, biologically alive, meaning it looks like it's got a nucleus, it looks like it's got something, okay, versus the hair,
Well,
you can see, if you look under a microscope, you can see like it's got a shaft, horsetail, the plant, horsetail.
I've looked at hairs under the microscope,
yeah,
yes.
Meaning it's, it looks totally different. Nothing like alive in it looking.
Right. So there's a biological appearance to what he's talking
right.
about.
Right. And he took pictures of it, so we're going to send it. We just didn't get it developed in time for the discussion.
Oh, that's
discussion.
Fine. Okay. Fascinating. But that's... So the chemtrail fiber and the current Morgellons fiber, there is a match or a certain similarity.
Oh, they have a red thread, wouldn't you say, Dr. Carju? That
yes.
one red thread?
Yes.
And it also has those other threads.
Okay, so we've got a link.
Yes.
Okay, all right. That's what I wanted to establish. Now, I want to bring Jan Smith on the program. Hi, Jan. Thank you for being so quiet back there.
Glad to be here, really.
Make some noise. That a girl.
I'm just so excited.
Have you met Dr. Staninger or Dr. Carju?
I've spoken to Dr. Staninger on the phone briefly, but I haven't met Dr. Carju.
Hi. Well, say hello.
Hi, Dr. Carju.
Hi, how are you doing?
Oh, I'm fine.
Well, she's not fine, but she's a very gracious woman. She's got Morgellons, the syndrome, the affliction of disease, and has had it for 8.5 years. She has been heroic in fighting it and sharing her travails and her Well, her ordeal with all of us. And what have you been hearing tonight that has especially intrigued you, Jan Smith, as a Morgellons sufferer?
Well, I'm especially happy to hear that someone has finally recognized a type of nematode in this. The thing with most of the sufferers of this disease is they notice several different strands, and some of them may just be a difference in color, but we have several different kinds of strands going on, and they don't all behave the same way. And that modal strand that I've mentioned to you before
right.
on the program is
right.
definitely the nematode.
Okay, that's the white one.
It's white, and then sometimes as it gets more mature, it gets to have white with little black specks in it, almost like a dotted line that runs through it.
Now, for those of you listening, there are how many commonly observed colors in the fibers, for example, from your body, Jan?
For me in particular, my fibers are usually clear to white. The preponderance of them are blue, and then a smaller amount of red every once in a while, a teal one or a purple one, but on a rare occasion.
Okay. Now, and what you're saying, the motile, and that's M-O-T-I-L-E for those of you listening.
Yeah, motile, yeah.
It means it moves. The white ones, or the whitish ones, and are you suggesting, are we all suggesting that those particular fibers could be some kind of a piece of living biology? Hildy?
Well, that from that, what we call phase three, what we just got from Dr. Castle, meaning it looks like something alive in it, meaning there's like a nucleus or something there.
Right.
And it could be in segments or like pearls.
Sure, I understand.
So like it's a chain of pearls with a casing over it, like a tube or that.
So do we think
so? Within the fiber.
Does that suggest?
Translucent fiber that could be white or opaque.
Uh-huh.
But you could, in this stage that we saw when we looked at it, Dr. Carju, who pointed it out to me, you could see that nuclear or whatever that live material is. Versus, there wasn't something dead, versus in the fibers adjacent to it, it looked like nothing in them.
Does that suggest that the this particular fiber, with whatever it is inside, in segments, cysts, whatever, was manufactured? Or is this a life form that is just, we don't recognize yet?
That's my problem right now. I don't understand that. The temperature, that high temperature that you mentioned, if we are dealing with the biological type of
1,700 degrees, it's gone.
Yeah, and if it is something else on the chemical things that would tolerate that high temperature, that's the area that I am getting very puzzled about it.
Right, and there are compounds in particular like powdered zirconia, which is made from man-made diamonds that burns at 3,000 degrees centigrade.
Mm-hmm.
We're the only manufacturer that makes liquid zirconia, Nanolabs. Create that burns at 2,000 degrees centigrade.
But biology can't handle 1,000 degrees. It can't handle 500 degrees. It can't handle 200 degrees.
No, when I first got involved with this, which was in the last 45 days to 60 days, just a week before Dr. Carju, before I sent over the slides, I was pleasured by having in our inspection for fire, fire extinguishers, the Los Angeles Fire Department came to do an inspection. There was four firemen, and I showed them the pictures because I just got the samples and everything.
Oh.
And at the same time, I said, do you ever know of what could burn, you know, what temperature does a human being burn at, you know, where it destroys his tissue or anything? And they said, well, on the outside, you know, from 100 to 105, and but definitely they can't withstand 1,700 degrees.
No.
So how in the world can a fiber be growing out at a that temperature?
Right.
Can I add something to that?
Go, Jan, please.
You know that Cliff and I had done the burn experiments. Cliff Mickelson, by the way, says hi.
Hi, great. Please explain to Hildy and Dr. Carju what your burn experiments were. And Dr. Carju, this will be new to him.
Okay. Actually, there's probably still photos at Jeff's site, but we took some of the blue fibers and we set a butane torch to them for 30 seconds, and we found that they didn't burn. We found that there was something on the inside that either melted and bulged just slightly on each end and turned it from a blue fiber to kind of a yellow, clearish substance. But we did this with a number of them, and they all behaved in the same way. And we estimated that the flame that we used was probably about 1,500 degrees.
So pretty tough fibers.
Yeah. But the thing I was going to say is I've also tried to burn what I consider to be the modal fibers. For the first 3 years I had this disease and I looked at these fibers, I thought they were cat hair. They are remarkably close to it. And those do burn.
The motile or the suspected motile fibers,
correct,
the white ones, do burn. Did they completely burn up to carbon, just gone?
Pretty much so.
Okay, they didn't melt, they burned.
Those particular ones didn't, so I don't know if anyone's replicated that on those particular fibers.
All right. You'll see Jan Smith photos in our Morgellons data file. And they're all there. Lots of pictures. Okay, stand by. We have to pause. We'll come right back with more. Our Morgellons special, number 5 tonight. Okay, let's get right back to our guest, Dr. Hildegard Stanninger.
Yeah.
Hildy?
Yes.
It is Stanninger, or is it?
Yes, Stanninger. Mm-hmm.
Good. All right. Thought I had it right. Okay. And Dr. Rahim Karju, medical doctor, and the offers he's made tonight are just extraordinarily heroic. And Jan
also
Smith.
I'm a pathologist.
You are an amazing pathologist, my friend. And
Thank you.
read his biology. He's taught pathology at Yale, and he is a genius in his field. So we've got two of the greatest minds in America working on this, and we have Jan Smith here, one of the most remarkably resilient people I've ever talked to. 8.5 years with this this nightmare infestation of whatever the heck it is. Go ahead, Jan. I want to hear more of what your views are and opinions about what you've heard tonight.
I'm just extremely excited. This is the best thing that's happened to me in 8 years. So I realize that there's no immediate cure, you know, next week. But, it's a real great place to start.
When the heaviest of the chemtrailing was going on, were you aware of it as reported, as the internet was picking it up and talking about it back then in the late 90s?
Personally, I was, and before I ever met anybody that was talking about chemtrails, I had already kind of equated those fibers with what I possibly had, and I was
Did
one of the
really?
People. Oh, yeah, I was running around with a roll of Scotch tape in my pocketbook, and every time I visited somebody's house, I would go over to the windowsill and take samples, and most of the time, I found red and blue fibers in my microscope when I brought them home.
That's amazing. What is your background? You're a nurse, I know.
No, actually.
Aren't you a nurse?
Actually, I was in teaching, but now I'm just kind of nosy.
That's an amazing story. That's a true scientific mind at work. So you found red and blue fibers. Did those fibers look like the fibers that are coming out of your body now?
Yes, they were. As a matter of fact, it was a coincidence. They were the same diameter. They were the same shades of red and blue primarily. What I also noticed with my overzealous mind was that the tiny fibers in money were also the same size and shape and color.
Huh.
So, basically the size of these fibers, in a lot of cases, it's whatever it would take you to see those fine linen-y fibers in the money. And they're not linen, by the way. They're probably made out of the same stuff we have. I just thought it was very curious that the color should be such a match.
Well, we've seen photographs taken in daylight after heavy spraying and the sunlight, and fibers, uncountable numbers of fibers show up in these photographs up in the bright sky.
Yeah.
And
my friend Cliff, who lives way out in Washington on a mountain, mm-hmm. Used to take tin pipe pans and grease them up with Vaseline and see how many he could catch, and he got a number of them.
That's extraordinary. I didn't know that. So you were on to this potential, at least potential link with chemtrails and chemtrail aerosol spraying 7-8 years ago.
Yeah, I was. And the one place that I didn't find any fibers, which may or may not mean anything, was my sister lives in Kennebunkport, Maine, and apparently she's in a no-fly zone because someone special lives up there, and there weren't any fibers in her house
you
at
all.
You
got it. You got it. None at all, huh?
Not a one.
Yeah, well, there were areas that were not sprayed. We know that, and I didn't know Kennebunkport was one of them, but it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so we have the potential here, Dr. Karju, Do you know what chemtrails are, by the way?
Who, me?
Yes.
I don't know too much about it.
Do you know anything about them at all? I'll give you a little briefing.
Yeah.
Around 1995-96, there began to be large jet aircraft overflying much, if not all, of the United States, which would leave behind them not the usual contrails, which evaporate in seconds or a minute or two, but persistent white trails behind them, which would literally stretch from horizon to horizon, and then they would spread out and completely cover the sky with a haze, what looked like to most people as clouds, but it was not. It was spray aerosol from these jetliners. Hmm. Were they military jetliners? Were they civilian jetliners? And they were flying with altered fuel? We don't know. These trails crisscrossed the country, crisscrossed most of the world, in fact, for years, and they're still being reported. That's what chemtrails are. You look on the internet, and if you go to Carnicom, CARNICOM, Carnicom.com, that is the best website. Clifford Carnicom did truly incredible research. Again, another citizen scientist, self-taught like Jan. You'll see pictures there which will explain the whole phenomenon to you. Well, it's not a phenomenon. It looks like an operation that was clearly in its deployed state. Nothing experimental about it at all. Jan, go ahead.
Oh, I was just thinking.
Thank you for the information.
You're welcome, sir.
I was just thinking while you were mentioning Clifford, he did a small excerpt on Morgellons disease there.
Yes, he did.
And I actually was the subject that he used the tissue from, but he has some magnified tissue specimens of something that I sent him that are, I believe, 5,800 magnification, which was pretty remarkable.
Well,
so you might
want
to check those out, too, when you go there.
Okay, well, let's look at Carnicom.com while we're talking. Now, you had just a 10-power scope, didn't you? 10X? What was it?
I have one that goes up to 200. But
200.
But Clifford has one that goes up to 5,800.
Okay, well, when you pull up Carnicom.com, I would urge all of you to do it. Look, and you will remember, if you haven't seen chemtrails lately, you'll see them. And the data on this site is extraordinary. And Clifford has waded into the Morgellons nightmare story. You'll see he's got a paper up there called Morgellons First Observations. And that is available to you as well. Well, thanks for letting us know on that. I'm scanning this paper now, and he does have a very high-powered magnification of some of these fibers. And also, I want to remind those of you who may have forgotten, but maybe you remembered at some point, and maybe you remember now, that there were, according to Clifford Carnicom's research, on many occasions, human blood cells found in the fallout from chemtrail aerosol spraying. These blood cells were apparently desiccated or freeze-dried or dried, but the chemtrail spraying operations were probably involved with a multiplicity of experiments, of research, and of potentially deployable operations. We don't know. But when you find human blood cells in these things, as well as the fibers that Jan has identified, and she was running around catching them with scotch tape 7-8 years ago, you have to think that, remember, all the people complaining about these things were not hallucinating, nor are the people with Morgellons hallucinating. We're seeing and experiencing real things. Go ahead.
I wanted to emphasize that it seems that Janis is very active in this Morgellons disease, and I would like to ask her that to be some sort of the public relations to introduce this Morgellons disease, and also maybe you can get the communicate with those ones that they have, and each state they would come up with some sort of group to get together and discuss about this,
mm-hmm.
and make it awareness of the community that there is such a this problem and it is not in their head, really. That's yeah. what I would like to ask journalists that help us in the public.
Oh, sure.
Public.
As a matter of fact, there are already message boards that have been up and running for years, and I posted them regularly.
I actually have a couple of questions for you, Dr. Kaju, from some of the people at the message boards. When they found that I was going to be on here with you, they had a couple of questions that they wanted to ask you.
Sure.
And one of the questions is, one of the phenomenon with this disease is that sometimes if you do something to one of the lesions on your body, simultaneously another lesion on another part of your body will begin to respond with the same pain. And I was wondering if you knew about that.
No, but there are some diseases in the skin, such as psoriasis, that if you touch or you scratch it, the other part of the body that has the same problem start having the same phenomenon, and you have to go and scratch that part too. And this is the neurological changes that it goes into the brain, and the same problem that is still in the skin, it would affect if you touch one or you scratch one. The other one you have to go in and scratch.
Fascinating. That's remarkable. Well, we've answered one question there. That's amazing.
I'll just give you one more question, and this one is a really big question for a lot of people.
Jan, we just have a minute left. You want to hold off?
Oh, why, sure.
Okay, let's do that. Let's hold off and get a comment from Dr. Staninger now, if we can, on what we've been talking about. Hildy?
Oh, I just want to add that the person that we got the slides and the other specimens, meaning the phase 1 and phase 2, they were diagnosed with delusional parasitosis, but definitely that phase 2, Dr. Kaju, wouldn't you say there was some kind of parasite in there? So it wasn't the one with the hook, it wasn't delusional at all.
No.
Nothing delusional about this. There has never been, and it's a pathetic commentary on dermatological medicine that it would treat people like that. Clearly, these lesions are not normal. They don't heal. They don't become infected. I mean, this is bizarre. Do go to carnicom.com, click on his Morgellons link, and look at some of the remarkable magnification photographs of these things. Hildy, have you seen them?
Yes, I have.
Okay,
and
Dr. Kaju, have you seen Carnicom's magnification?
Yes, yes.
Well, this shows those cyst-like formations within these fibers in one of them. I see round items which look like eggs or some kind of biology packed in there.
Right. It looks alive versus just just like a fiber, you know.
5,600 power. Thanks, Clifford Carnicom, if you're listening, very much, as always, for your incredible work. Those are some amazing pictures. All right, stand by. We'll be right back with Dr. Hildegard Staniger, Ph.D., Dr. Rahim Kaju, M.D., and Jan Smith. And yours truly, of course. We'll all be back in just a few minutes. Okay, right back. Hour number 3 of our 5th special on Morgellons syndrome. We have some magnificent people on the program with us tonight. If you're late, you can hear it in the archives, of course. Dr. Hildegard Staniger, Ph.D., Dr. Rahim Kaju, M.D., and Jan Smith, remarkable woman. I just got a note from Lori Kramer, email, thanks, Lori, that pointed me back to a story at Rents.com. And the story was entitled, How to See Mystery Chemtrail Aerosol Filaments, written by Sue Miller, in August of 2003. And she says, the unusual phenomena being described here and at various chemtrail aerosol activity boards is being called by different names. Aerosol polymer filaments and webs. Mike Castle came up with that one. Chemtrail fibers, microfilaments, sky webs, chemtrail fallout, electrostatic filaments, CT particulates, perhaps even Morgellons. Now, this was written 3 years ago. Sue says, I like the term fibrils as it implies a synthesized microfiber with conductive properties. Actually, Sue wrote that. Moondog at Carnicom was the source. But whatever they end up being called, they are real and they are observable. See for yourself. It's simple. And she goes on to describe how you can use a black light and see these things. This is, again, going back 3 and 4 and 5 and first note, 6 years ago with black lights, these things were being seen. Sue writes, they are, well, she says, let me go back, to actually witness these filaments covering you and your children, your pets, your home, your plates, your pillow, and your possessions can be very shocking. They are all over us. They are floating in the air. They are entwined in all that extra dust you have been wiping up lately throughout your home and the dust on your car. They are clogging your AC and your furnace filters. They are landing on your food between the plate and your mouth. We are all wearing them, eating them, drinking them, breathing them. And they are virtually invisible except under ultraviolet light. Well, we have come to find out that they're also visible under powerful magnification. Right, Jan Smith?
Yeah, that's correct. I actually wanted to mention that another a person that I had been reading for quite a while, and there used to be an actual whole web video on him, was a man named William Thomas, who is a Canadian journalist that has documented chemtrails and also the contents of what he's found in chemtrails, which have all turned out to be bad bacteria and fungus.
Right. Yeah, well, you know William for years. Okay, your other question for Dr. Carju. By the way, Dr. Carju, did you find that interesting?
Yes, it's very interesting.
I've sent the link to Shoshana, and she'll have it available for you. You can go look at that story as well.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Okay, Jan, go ahead, please.
A big question that a lot of Morgellons people have, and especially the ladies, is what is it that happens to people's hair follicles that causes it to be so distorted? It appears that this pathogen is not only just getting into the hair to some point, but it's almost taking over the follicles and making the hair turn into something else. I'm not an authority on hair follicles, but how do those work in regards to pathogens?
Well, whatever that goes under the skin, that if it goes a little bit deeper to affect on the hair follicle, it creates inflammation, infections, and fibrosis, healing. And all these changes continue to be done. And sometimes if the skin gets open, other microorganisms on the environment get in and cause, they call it the phlebitis. And the inflammation of the hair follicle.
But, Jan, don't some of these people have like a coating that goes over their hair?
Well, what they're saying is, and excuse me, but we've talked about this at great length, and it's fascinating and scary. What the Morgellons victims are saying, at least on this program, is that these fibers begin to grow in the hair follicle and displace the hair entirely. It's gone, and the fiber takes the place and grows out of that follicle. Is that correct, Jan?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, there's a couple of photos on your website that show a burn experiment, and I had a big thing that was growing in a hair follicle. I can't say that it was a hair, but Cliff had named those macrofibers, and they seem to totally replace the hair and be a totally different thing living out of that follicle.
And they grow.
Yeah, they grow. They get a lot bigger than a hair, and they split into sections, and sometimes there's 5 or 6 fibers all coming out of this one organism in the follicle.
Now, Dr. Carju, what you just heard, if that's true, and we certainly believe it is true, that these fibers take over and throw a hair follicle, throw the hair out of the follicle, begin growing out of the follicle, and sometimes sprout 4 or 5 fibers, and they grow, they are growing. What does that suggest to you, sir?
Well, right now, tonight, Hindegard brought me a fibers that came from the doctor. He's going to explain it to you. And this is the one that right away I put it under the microscope. And the doctor says that if he was combing his hair and this fiber coming out. And those fiber was the one that I mentioned before.
Mm-hmm.
And Hindegard mentioned before was the one that it doesn't look like a hair.
There you go.
And then I put the Hindegard hair and the microscope next to it,
mm-hmm.
It's two different kind of the structure on the microscope.
Well, I remember you mentioning that. What I'm getting at, and the part that perplexes me the most, is how do these fibers grow? Through what kind of system are they growing? We're not talking about necessarily the biological fiber. We're talking about the others. If they're created through nanotechnology, are they feeding off the body? They have to be somehow synthesizing body nutrients to make mass, I would think, if they're growing, correct?
Right. Making nutrients using the body source, the terrain,
right.
What they're living in for it to live, and at the same time maybe like cell sensing and a biosensor where it either is running on tones of the cell, because UCLA just in university in Fort Worth just identified that you can stimulate proteins by different sounds.
Oh, yes. Acoustics and sonic resonant energies are the future of so many areas of medicine.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And at the same time, if the hair can be inhibited, meaning the follicle, meaning whatever this new fiber, I'm going to call it the new fiber, comes in and can inhibit the growth of the hair follicle, so it's like under the skin, and then it could grow out.
Well, they're suggesting the hair is gone. Now, my question to Dr. Carju and Dr. Staniger is that, are these fibers then alive, or are they accreting minerals to grow like crystals grow? What are the potentials here, Dr. Carju?
The only thing that I really can tell you that if I have enough cases and be able to do biopsies of those areas that I see the fibers, go deeper and see that what is that replacing the hair follicles and the microscopes, and then we can come out and say that what is this product, what is this kind of the fibers, where it comes from, and how they are living under the skin. I cannot say anything until that at least I have about 50 cases from the different part of the,
yes,
the skin.
Of course.
And go around and see that really what are we dealing with. That's what I make announcement that they are welcome. Walk into my clinic and we go ahead and do the biopsy from different part if they have it in different part of their skin. Or they send me the sample with the information, and we go ahead and start doing the evaluation. Maybe I could have a chance about 4 weeks or 4 months to come back again and ask you I have some information for the public to announce that what is this problem, what is this disease, how it comes, and then maybe there are some area that's like any kind of the treatment that we go around and find out how to fight with these fibers.
Very good. Well, you're certainly welcome here. We will have you back as soon as you're ready. Not a problem.
And if you want, I hope that you have the information about my lab, my clinic, and also I would be happy to give you my email.
Very good. I'm going to go ahead and post that. The American Medical Diagnostic Laboratories, Inc. in Santa Ana, California, the zip code, and Dr. Carju's email address. And I would request that you only use his email address with very serious questions. And if you are interested in availing yourself of his most gracious offer to work at no charge with Morgellons sufferers. All right, we'll be back in just a couple minutes. Okay, and we're back live. I think we should at this point mention something that some of you may have surmised early on in the program tonight. The samples on the knee joint tissues came from our guest, Jan Smith. It's not a big secret. Jan has been on the program before. You've had both knees replaced, isn't that correct?
Yes, I have.
And fibers were found just prolifically in both knee joints. Now, this second operation, I understand that the doctors behaved a little differently toward you than they did the first time around when they were rather surprised to find a knee literally crawling, not crawling, but packed with these fibers.
Only because of their awareness that samples were going to be taken to research a specific disease. And then
once they had that realization, I think that they may have done the preventative measures that they did take by putting me in isolation and having people have to come in and take on and off disposable gowns before they came and went. I don't know if that was just to cover them or or me, but...
We should also mention that, talk about the issue of vectoring and communicability. Well, this is an epidemic issue. We suspect that Morgellons may be transmissible through body fluids. We suspect they may be transmissible through direct contact and self-inoculation. We don't know for sure. What are your thoughts on it, Jan? And we'll go around from everyone.
Oh, well, anecdotally, you know, you realize that you've talked to people on the internet, and a person has this disease, and they get a new partner, and 3 months later, they're on there saying, "Now my partner has this disease too." So you kind of have
to
wonder.
That's a pretty fast turnaround.
If it didn't pass from one person to the next, and it's happened more than once. And as a matter of fact, in my family, I believe my other family members have this. What I have come to understand is many people think they have this and they don't have the lesions, but they have many of the other symptoms. And my other family members have the colored fibers in the hairbrush, although they don't have the lesions on them.
How long would the fibers be in the hairbrush?
Actually small enough so that you would probably have to put it under the microscope and take a look at it. Because these fibers basically are all kind of the same size as we were talking before about those tiny fibers that are in a dollar bill that you'd have to look really closely at with a magnifying glass to see them.
Except for the ones that grow out of hair follicles and are observable.
Well, actually, when we kind of named those macrofibers because they're so big. They seem to be a whole other breed of cat. They're a different fiber altogether. Hmm. And as a matter of fact, on your website, there's still some photos of these, and it comes under the heading of Stunning Photos Number 2.
Right.
And it's called a macrofiber. It's probably halfway down the page. But they're easily seen with the naked eye. They're kind of monsters.
Okay. Now, just to recap what we do know, entire families have Morgellons, and you just heard from Jan that people taking on new partners, the partners show up with Morgellons in a matter of weeks, 10 to 12 weeks. We have the story of the Oakland A's baseball pitcher. I've forgotten his name now.
Billy Cook.
Billy Cook.
Or Koch, I'm not sure.
I think it's Koch, maybe, K-O-C-H, but whatever. At any rate, his career was ended with Morgellons, and his entire family has it now, his wife and his three children. And these are little children. So clearly this is a communicable infectious issue. Infectious not necessarily in the sense of being infected by a bacterium or a virus or maybe even any microorganism. We just don't know, but infectious nonetheless. Hildy, what do you take on this?
I agree. None of us really know what's going on with it as a vector, but it's definitely infecting other family members. And I also shared with an individual yesterday who contacted me, or 2 days ago rather, that was very similar to a personal friend of mine that where a water main broke. My friend, they had a main break in their apartment versus this other individual had one break outside a sewer line.
Right.
And within a time after that, they ended up having it.
Really?
More
did
of
they get,
the, I'm going to call it the nematode or the little worm type thing.
Did they get doused?
They were like this? In it, in the water.
I got it.
My personal friend, meaning the pipe busted in the bathroom, and he had about 6 inches of water throughout his apartment. Versus the other person that called me, they were working in their yard, and their pipe it already happened, a sewer line broke.
Well, all right. That means the potential of the body shedding these fibers and they being in an infectious state.
Right, and it may be very similar to what happened with EPA with endocrine disruptors, meaning all the pharmaceuticals that we all take or not take, even chemotherapy agents, et cetera. We all have body waste that we get out of our body, and it goes to the local sewer.
Okay, so we have again that we've made almost a full circle back to the idea that the body is the medium. And as the medium is corrupted or changed or modified or manipulated, maybe with foods, artificial issues in our foods, toxins, additives, that could trigger this or certainly enhance its chances for proliferation. We don't know.
Right. And a prime example of the media is just like in AIDS patients, they die from secondary fungal infection.
Very good point. Of course, HIV... in and of itself doesn't kill the patients. There are over 30 different opportunistic infections that will kill AIDS patients. That's what happens because the immune system is eradicated. Stand by. We'll be right back with our special guests tonight and our fifth special program, another world exclusive for you here tonight, the latest scientific data on Morgellons disease. Hi, we're back. Dr. Carju, we're talking about vectoring and communicability here of an unknown disorder. You have no scientific data yet to make any formal prognostications or postulations, but what are your thoughts on this, given what we've anecdotally presented tonight about communicability?
Well, I have, as it was mentioned, that in the family that one person has, the other member of the family already have it. So it seems that it's something that would be transferred from one person to the other.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes sense because this is covered the skin and could jump or touch from one part, one person, to another person.
Right.
And this is just the way that has been coming to me. It was not known before now. As you mentioned, there are many places and different countries showing the same kind of the sign and symptoms.
Right, exactly. It is literally spread around the world now.
Yep.
So what we have here is the idea that these fibers, if they are the, I'm going to use the term infective advisedly, if they are the infective agent, can they simply by touching someone penetrate the skin and go systemic and set up shop and then potentially, if this is the progression of this disorder, then erupt in skin lesions later on? Can they penetrate the skin? Are these fibers so small, Dr. Carju, that they can penetrate the skin potentially, or do they have to go in through an opening, the nasal opening, the mouth?
Always the skin have some hole that when you, for instance, perspiration,
uh-huh.
There are in the hole in the skin that the skin breathes always. And then these fibers probably can penetrate with that or another factor that I have seen in some of the picture, dry out and make a kind of the crack on the skin and get through of it.
Oh, make its own opening.
Right. And I have seen some of the... It was a picture of the hand and foot that I saw it on the program that it create some sort of the crack to get in.
Interesting.
Eat up, like, for instance, eat up the keratin and the surface of the skin and make it easy for them to penetrate and get inside.
Ah.
And I want to add a comment because Dr. Carju was pointing this picture out. Because it was a person in from the Intercell from Pensacola. The thing is that he also mentioned that you see similar cracks with vitamin E deficiency. Thus, one is having the deficiency or where a parasite or an organism can rob that area of the vitamin E.
Very interesting. Now, for those of you who may not know, I just want to make sure you understand how qualified our experts are tonight. Dr. Staninger's paper is extracted up there. The excerpts are self-explanatory. There's a major paper on far infrared light, which we're going to talk about, hopefully, with her on a future program. Would that be okay?
Oh, that would be a wonderful thing.
Well, we will do that. And certainly Dr. Carju's background is extraordinary. His passion, among other things, for many years has been the pathology of migration of silicon in human tissue. His silicon implant research has been published, it was published over 10 years ago now. Many other papers published. He's received awards and credits for just superb dedication and distinguished service to all of us as a medical doctor. Taught at Yale University, a pathologist of world-renowned stature. And we have the team. And I would also suggest to all of you out there that I'm going to put Dr. Carju's contact data up in the featured story box on Morgellons. If any of you have the wherewithal and would like to donate some money to research, this little group of heroes could certainly use it. We're going to grow, and it will be something that will be more than appreciated. So don't hesitate to put your money where your heart is in this case.
I would like to add a comment. In my original phase one testing from the analytical standpoint, where one portion was finding the fiber was high-density polyethylene fiber, that particular type of fiber was it had a melting point, and it like dissolved. Versus, we're still waiting for some of the a lot of the results from the other labs that we haven't received yet.
So there are results pending. They're done,
oh,
but
definitely.
We haven't picked them up yet.
Meaning electron microscope, everything. Meaning we're determined to find out what the chemical composition is and all biological matter associated with
it. What would an electron microscopy reveal?
Oh, it could reveal the shape of the molecule or whatever we're looking at.
Uh-huh.
And also through other aspects of it, it can tell if it's carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, what the source is, silica, what the source is.
Wow. Jan, if this is successfully tied into the chemtrail aerosol deployment over the United States, this is going to be a huge, huge story. It already is.
I want to add, in this latter phase of the chemical analysis, we have not just samples from the United States, but we have from Australia and three different locations, like the West Coast, Florida, versus the upper northern area of the United States. So it's like four different locations, and they're all getting the same test.
Right. Hilde, did you study this chemtrail issue at all in the past? Did you have time to look at it?
I've always been intrigued by it.
Could these fibers then have been manufactured in the quantities necessary to literally coat this country from one end to the other, and many other countries as well, on multiple continents, and somehow put in the jet fuel of commercial aviation planes? Or, and people used to ask me, well, they don't have enough tankers to do that. Well, that's not true. A DC-10, a K-1, forgotten the number on it, 130 or something, could fly from Seattle to Los Angeles in 3 hours or thereabouts or less. And if you had 10 of them working in a tandem or certainly staggered intervals, they could cover an enormous area of an entire coast of a continent in one day. You don't need that many tankers. What were your thoughts on the deployment of these chemtrails back then?
Well, back then I used to even hear stories of how they took the toilets out and put the pipes in the planes.
Right. I remember that, too. We never had verification of that, but it was intriguing.
I know I used to take photographs of it myself when I lived in Florida, and it was amazing how in the morning you'd have the most beautiful blue sky, and then by the end you had nothing. And also, when I lived in different countries, they didn't have any chemtrails, but now they do.
Indeed. Okay, I never forget the first one I saw either. Okay, back in a couple of minutes. Just a fascinating program tonight. We have a long way to go, but we are starting. Go ahead. All right, I think we're back and talking to our special guest tonight. Jan Smith, you've lost two knees. Do you have any suspicion that your knees were lost to you because of this Morgellons fiber issue?
Not until they actually did the first surgery and they did disclose that there were a bunch of fibers in my knee.
Now, they could see, remember, they could see the fibers, They didn't. They weren't as tiny as you'll find in paper currency.
These they considered it to be fibrosis, which apparently can happen. I'm not positive of the difference between what they were calling fibrosis and the fibers that were found.
Well, maybe they aren't either. Who knows? They may not know either.
No, I mean, obviously the fibers that we have weren't defined by any lab that I know of, so whatever they saw would be whatever they thought I came closest to.
All right. Anything else, Jan, you want to talk to Dr. Carju about or Dr. Staninger?
Well, the only thing I want to say is thank you so much because, I mean, even to take on anything to do with the chemtrail issue is putting your neck on the chopping block, and I hate to put it in those terms, but there's a lot more to it than just science here. There's a lot of politics. So, I mean, thank God for you that you were willing to do this.
Well, thank you very much. All of us need your help, too.
I'm here.
Well, I'll tell you, I remember, I know a lot of you out there were with us covering this issue of chemtrails. We've been covering it for years. And now we have, apparently, a solid link. And this was raised in that story that I mentioned earlier 3 years ago. Morgellons was mentioned, potential there. So if we have some solid links, which I think we do, we can build on that. We'll get Clifford Carnicom involved in this further as well. And there's a lot to do, but we have made tremendous progress. And remember, for those of you listening who joined late, both Dr. Hildegard Staninger and Dr. Carju have only been involved with this for, what, 6 weeks, Hildy?
Yes, and to get those results that Dr. Carju looked at and also the high-density polyethylene fiber, we got that in 40 days, 41 days. We had one more day than Noah did.
Well, that's a remarkable achievement. Have you, Dr. Staninger, do you know anybody personally or many with Morgellons? Have you run across this often?
I've run across it. I hear of it now, but I had three people contact me. One was Janice Smith, and then my personal friend that... what do you call when his pipe broke?
Yeah.
He got it. He called me because he had a lot of things going on. And at the same time, the patient that's in Intracell.
Okay. Well, I have a hunch
but
you're
going to But I know there's a lot more now.
I think you're going to be hearing about a lot more very soon. Jan, this disorder, disease, syndrome, affliction, whatever we want to call it, tragically has hit many children. And I just can't even imagine what it would be like to be a parent and have to tell your child that, you know, you've got something. Those sores all over your body aren't going to go away. We don't know what it is. This is not a joke. This is a very serious, grave illness, which has resulted in the loss of life, as I mentioned, of a couple of people that we know about who have committed suicide. God only knows how many others around the world have been suffering and in quiet agony and have decided to check out. We just don't know enough. Hopefully people will come forward now.
Yeah, I'm praying for that. You know, fortunately for me, the daughter that I do have that has this is in her 30s. If she was a young child, I would not know what to tell her or him. It's a tragic thing. And I'm still waiting for the CDC to acknowledge this, but I'm not counting on it.
No, well, let's not hold our breath.
No.
They've appointed what they call a task force, which is going to sally forth and save the day or figure it out. Well, I think they're going to be trailing behind you, Hildy, and certainly Dr. Carju for a long time to come. I'll be interested to see if they contact you, if anyone contacts you directly to consult with you about your research and your findings, and again, there's data that has been concluded, which hasn't been picked up yet because it takes money to pick up the results from some of these labs. But that'll be interesting to see, or if they'll just tap your phones and monitor your email.
But remember, we have plenty of space over at Dr. Carju's center, and I know from one newspaper article, some of the CDC were looking for, I'm going to say medical office.
Uh-huh.
So they're more than welcome to be here with us.
Well, let's get an invitation out to this so-called task force and let them know where you guys are and that there is space available and invite them to check in with you.
Yeah, because it would be good, a very good study with them and Dr. Carju, and doing it as a very good team.
Oh, absolutely. And if they say no, it'll be interesting to see that, and we'll put that up on the Internet as well.
And I want to add something. In the earlier, not studies, but data, and I was shared with me that when it was, whatever was happening with these fibers, that some of the, I'm going to say from the chemtrails, that some of the animals died that were in the woods.
Correct.
In particular, reptiles, meaning like snakes and turtles.
Well, we're losing amphibians now, of course, right and left.
Right, they had the fibers coming out of their eyes. And
oh, true?
The audience, and remember that they're cold-blooded, meaning a lower temperature.
I don't remember this.
And there may be something related with that versus we're warm-blooded, a higher temperature. In other words, what I'm saying is maybe whatever's going on with this organism or fiber or many things that may be in it, it might be heat-sensitive or photosensitive, meaning attracted to the light, like these fibers growing out, versus being repelled if you had enough far infrared into your cells that it stays encapsulated. A lot of things may be going on.
Right. I wonder if anyone's checked any of the amphibians. I know where I live, there are no frogs this year. Every year you hear frogs. Well, no frogs. No noise in the summer evenings. No sound of frogs. And they are withering away fast on the landscape of this tormented planet of ours. Dr. Carju, any other comments you'd like to make tonight? We have just a couple of minutes left.
I wanted to mention to Janice that don't be disappointed or don't think that there is no any help or treatment. The only thing that we could go ahead is find out what is this fiber and how it affects on the skin and how far it goes in. And meanwhile, where it comes from, because we have to find out where is the sources of this going from where, from the sky, from the ground, from somewhere is, we have to go to sources of where it's coming from.
And some people suggest, Dr. Carju, that these things may have come from space, from off-planet. I guess we can't rule that out at this point, can we?
Exactly. So this is something that I said that I would be happy to put all my time to go ahead and do whatever research is to get to the bottom of this problem.
Well, that's more than noble of you.
And I would like to have the public help for me to go ahead and send me these specimens, come over here, we take care of it, and little by little, I cannot sit down and look at two fibers and say, okay, this is just a fiber.
Right.
I have to go analyze completely from surface to the deep. Also go ahead and make an antibody against this and inject it.
Right.
And find out that what is going on. This is the way that all these diseases, they could find out, they could find a treatment on it, or they get the vaccination for it. And this is one of those that is unknown, and we have to work for it.
This is a great challenge. Dr. Carju, thank you so very much for being here. I've put your contact information up in the Morgellons Disease featured box at rents.com now, so people will be contacting you via email. And we'll be back in touch, and I look forward to our next conversation, sir.
Thank you very much for your help. It was a great, and you know more medicine than I do.
Oh, no. I thank you for being here again, sir. We'll talk soon. And Jan Smith, thank you so much for being here. I assume you're going to be working together, all three of you, and let's look for good things soon.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you
very much. And we're going to send you the photographs that we discussed earlier on the show.
Okay.
As we get them developed.
That's great. And again, I want to mention that if any of you out there would like to financially contribute, and this is a citizen's effort at this point, There is some very elaborate and eclectic data that has been done in terms of laboratory work, and we want to pick that up as soon as possible. So by all means, you can contact me. We'll get the people together, and if you can financially help, this will move us all forward. You're going to hear about it all here first and see it at Rentz.com as well. Thank you, Dr. Staninger, very much for being here.
You're welcome. My pleasure, and God bless all the audience.
Okay, and we'll talk soon. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Good night.
Good night.
All right, and thanks to all of you. There's a lot to think about with this, as you well know. And outer space, who knows? But we've established, I think, now clearly the potential for a very serious link with the chemtrail aerosol application program, which has been underway now for the better part of almost a decade. I guess it is a decade. All right, another one in the books for you. And we'll be back with you in 21 hours. In the meantime, we'll see you at Rentz.com.